This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in German Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Paul Lerner, from the University of Southern California, and I'm delighted to introduce today's guest, Guy Miron. Guy Miron is professor of history at the Open University in Israel. He's a prolific scholar with a broad range of interests in modern Jewish history, historiography, emancipation, anti-Semitism, and the Holocaust. He's written and edited many books and dozens of articles in several languages. Among his English language books are The Waning of Emancipation, Jewish History, Memory, and the Rise of Fascism in Germany, France, and Hungary, which appeared with Wayne State Press in 2011, a volume he co-edited with Scott Urey, Anti-Semitism and the Politics of History, which just appeared with Brandeis University Press, and another co-edited book on Jewish historiography between past and future, 200 Years of Wissenschaft des Judentums, which came out with De Gruyter in 2019. Welcome, Guy.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. Let me start by giving you an opportunity to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, about your path as a historian and your interests and the trajectory which led to your book, which I should mention is called Time and Space and Time Under Persecution, The German Jewish Experience in the Third Reich, which appeared in English translation in 2023 with the University of Chicago Press.
Yeah, so I was born and grew up in Jerusalem, and my training as a historian is focused on Jewish history, and I want to emphasize this. Of course, Jewish history is not a discipline. History is a discipline. Jewish history is a field, but it's not German history. And whereas most of my colleagues dealing with German Jewish history in the States, in Germany, and also in Israel, are playing basically with German history, because you have to be very deep inside the context, the sources, the arena of German history to deal with it. My training was focused on a larger scale on Jewish history. So my tendency is to deal a lot also with a comparative perspective. After reading a few books about German Jewish history, I will read also about Jews in Poland, in France, and even in North Africa and Iraq. And some of my articles and part of my scholarship, I tend to be more comparative. I think this has to do also with my tendency for a more long, direct question. And even in this book, which deals only with 12 years, I try to ask some of the questions from the perspective of a more long way, take some of the concepts that I used and trying to do it in a more wider perspective. My first book based on my dissertation, which was published only in Hebrew, some articles are published in English, dealt with the memoirs and autobiographies of German Jews who left Germany, mostly Nazi Germany, sometimes Weimar Germany, immigrated to Palestine and wrote their life stories in Palestine / Israel. And I tried to use some tools from literature, from different cultural studies, from psychology, from literature, to analyze the way they reconstructed their life stories in a variety of ways. And then I turned in my second monograph, which was published in English, as you mentioned, to a comparative perspective. analyzing German Jewry, French Jewry, and Hungarian Jewry under the age of fascism, and trying to see how they use the historical narratives, mostly in the Jewish press, in these different Jewish communities, in order to shape their cultural comments and coming to terms with the rise of fascism in the 1930s, early 1940s. And this is now my third monograph.
And I think the, in a sense, what you mentioned at the beginning is really interesting to me, that you approach this as really a historian of modern Jewish history as opposed to a Germanist, which is the background of many of the scholars who work in the history of Nazi Germany. And one sees that in this book very much, that you're thinking about time and kind of the Jewish calendar, the rhythms, that kind of you're bringing a perspective that I think is often lost by people who are less familiar with either Jewish religious traditions or kind of broader patterns in Jewish history. So that really appears throughout the book. And I think that's maybe before we get deeper into the book, I wanted to ask you about the process of translation, because of course this book was originally written in Hebrew. And if I'm not mistaken, it appeared in 2021. And I think a more literal translation of the title might be being Jewish in Nazi Germany, place and time, as opposed to the way it's rendered here in Space and Time Under Persecution. Is there was that just a choice because of the way it sounds in English, or is there more to the change in title from being Jewish to Space and
Time? I think it's most of the way it sounds in English. I think sometimes if you translate things too literally, it doesn't sound so good in the other language. But I'm a very native Israeli, I should confess. I mean, English is my second language. I didn't spend a long time in the United States, so I really need a professional translator in this case, and I chose Chaim Watzman. I think he's one of the best, and I really deeply thank him for this professional work. It was an intensive process of dialogue between us. You know, I didn't just leave this to him. He came back to me time and again, and he helped me to find a lot of mistakes and bugs that in the Hebrew version I didn't find. And because of the process of translation, which was so intensive, in a way the English version is more... is a little more accurate. And through the translation, you think about the book again. I mean, because when you translate yourself, you have to think again about the same things. Just to let you, to give you an example about how I function in different languages, sometimes when I get to a conference in the United States or in front of English audience, I prepare the lecture in Hebrew, and I translate it while reading it to the public. And this is much more vivid than just, you know, taking the text and reading the text, which is quite boring in a way. Because when you translate, you think about the things again and you recreate it. And this is also the process of working with Chaim with this book and making it possible.
That seems like such a much more lively process, more dynamic process, and must make a paper much more interesting for the listeners as well. I think also what's interesting is that the book, most of your sources are in German language. So when you originally yeah. wrote the book, you were often going from German to Hebrew, and now you're going from German to English, maybe sometimes through the Hebrew. And I wonder because...
Yeah, but I had to check again all the sources with the process of translation. And in many cases, my translator doesn't read German. But in many cases, he made me go back again to the sources and check again and see if I was accurate. And by the way, now I'm in the process of translating the book to German, from Hebrew to German. So my German translator is also very good. Almut Laufer also forced me to go back again to the sources and check everything again. And each time you do it, you find a little more bugs and you are more accurate. But this is a process. Eventually, you have to publish the book.
Wow, yeah. And I guess because language is so important to, right, you're doing so much textual analysis in the book, I think that must make translation questions really urgent in some cases, right?
Definitely. My first book, which was published also in English, The Waning of Emancipation, I did the translation myself, and then I took an editor. And this process was much less dialogue. And I don't know, you have to read it to tell me what you think about, but this time it was much, I don't think it was a smoother process, but it was much more intellectual and deeper process because of the dialogue.
That makes sense. And the result is quite smooth. I mean, it's very elegantly written in the English. Absolutely. And so perhaps now we could get a little bit more into the content and the thinking behind the book. And if I could just ask you to kind of introduce the concepts this way, perhaps what, in your opinion, doing an analysis of Jewish life in Nazi Germany, which foregrounds categories such as space and time, what does that add to our understanding of the period? Or perhaps you could tell us why you picked these particular categories as your key analytical concepts.
Yeah, I mean, I'm deeply invested in this period and in the sources long before I came to this book. And I wanted to do something new and not more of the same. And it took me time to think about it. During the time in which I thought about the book and which the idea came to me before, and, you know, it began with the articles and the long process, I was more in touch with scholars from cultural studies, from social studies, than with historians. And my challenge was to ask a question which will be of interest not only to other historians of German Jewry or to other historians of Germany, but will interest also my friend who is a sociologist or anthropologist, and will create a dialogue between us. And this was my departure point. And I found that some of their works, of the people dealing with a more contemporary, more theoretical perspective about, you know, current Israeli society or American society or German society and so on, are asking many questions that we historians are not asking. And since the sources in my period, so to say, in the period of German Jews under the Holocaust, and we have to get back to it and maybe explain why the sources are so rich, because we deal with a bourgeois society with a huge cultural fortune, even in this terrible situation, this is kind of a laboratory that I can go back in time and ask the same question that some of the scholars are asking today about current society. Just to give an example, it was more than 10 years ago that I heard a lecture about the central bus station in Tel Aviv, analyzed through time and space. And I said, if they can do it about the central bus station in Tel Aviv, maybe I can take it to my topics. Initially, I thought mostly about time. This was the initial idea of the project. And this, in a way, continued my previous project about usable past of the Jews in Germany and in other countries. So the chapter about Jewish holidays, the way the Jews recreated their calendar, was the beginning of this project. But then I thought, no, it's not enough, because this could be maybe an article. But if I want to deal with calendars, this has to be more theorized. So I have to read about time. So I began to read about sociology of time and Robert Elias, Eviatar Zerubbabel, many other scholars dealing with it. And then I also looked for historians dealing with questions of time. For example, the books of Mona Ozouf about time and space in the French Revolution, another book dealing with Elizabethan England. And then I realized that they do time and space together. And in a way, it is basically the same question with two sides of the coin. So I have to get back. And then you come and read the sources and you see how these things are combined. This is, in a way, the way I got to this topic. And when I got to the sources, and I give you the best example, which is Victor Klemperer. You know, Victor Klemperer is the most famous diarist, Jewish converted, but Jewish diarist during the period I dealt with. And he's so much researched. And great scholars like Stephen Asheim, my teacher, and many others wrote about him. And before coming to read Klemperer, I said, what can I do new about Klemperer? But when I came with this new question, so the questions like Klemperer's Jewish identity or political views were not of my interests. I had much more specific questions to ask him. And I thought, I found out that I have a treasure, that there's so many new things I didn't think about. When you come with this new question, you with these new analytical tools and use the theoretical literature on the one hand, the social studies scholarship on the other hand, and also the historians dealt with other periods, and it wasn't done in the period I deal with, this was the frame of reference for me to begin the work.
I see. That really comes across in the analysis, and that you're constantly drawing on historiography and kind of other theoretical currents to really enliven this particular discussion. And since you bring up Klemperer, I did notice that in the book that I'm familiar with the diaries, and I also read a lot of the first kind of wave of scholarship about them, but I never saw this in them until I read your book. And I think you, one of your real contributions is shedding new light on some of the familiar sources, but at the same time, you bring in some sources that are not familiar, or at least much less familiar. And so I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how you chose the sources and what there's a kind of range from probably Klemperer as the most familiar to some that are really obscure today, and kind of where you found them, how you decided what to include and what not to include.
Yeah. So basically, I had two major corpuses of sources and additional, but basically two main major corpuses. One is ego documents, which included diaries and correspondences. I didn't deal too much with memoirs. As I mentioned before, my first book was dealing only with memoirs. But I think when we want to analyze time, you cannot really use the retrospective perspective. You have to read the things as they were written during the time that the people are writing about. So a lot of ego documents. I think I should make a separation between the diaries and the correspondences, because most of the diaries are written by men, and more specifically the diaries which are more intensive, like Victor Klemperer and Hans Kohn, and Willy Kohn, sorry. Victor Klemperer and Willy Kohn, my two major heroes, I would say, both were written by men around my age, around 50 to 60, struggling with their age, by the way. I found it very interesting. I mean, I would say maybe because of the period, maybe because time was changing, I feel myself much younger than they felt themselves. But this may be because, you know, people live longer today, maybe because of the circumstances. But they are, you know, intellectuals, and all intellectuals are also frustrated even before the Nazi period. So I found myself quite associated with them. But this is my comfort zone. So I wanted to expand it, and I went to look for other diaries of, you know, more simple people coming from the periphery, not so educated, younger people, and of course, women. And it's more difficult to find longer diaries of women. Let me explain why by going back to Willy Kohn. Willy Kohn is writing a lot about his daily life and also mentioning his wife, and he's always complaining, not always, time and again complaining that she doesn't have time to talk to him. Because he's not able to share with her all his reflections. But if you read the diary and understand how they live their life, she is making it possible for him to find the time to write his diary and to write his scholarship, because she's taking care of their daughters. And this division of labor between Jewish men and women in this very bourgeois society created the situation that women diaries, they exist, but not so like diaries of men. And this is why correspondences, family correspondences, are much more balanced from the gender perspective. And this was a very important tool for me. And I would say even that, because, as you know, women live longer. And I will add to this, that Jewish men, because of the Nazi anti-Jewish policy, which culminated during the Reich pogrom Nacht in November, were more endangered. So they tended to leave Germany more than women. So more older women remain in Germany and have a fewer correspondences of Jewish women to their children living abroad, reaching even until the early 1940s, a very rich source, which in a way balanced my men-oriented diaries. To this, I will add the second major corpus of sources, which is Jewish press, Jewish actually public arena, and the Jewish press in the Nazi Germany. One of the things I'm doing in one of my projects in the National Institute of Holocaust Research at Yad Vashem, this is my additional position, is editing a series of articles about Jewish press in Nazi Germany, which is a very, very rich source, and if you're not involved in this period, you might be surprised, but the Nazis enabled Jews quite a free pass as long as they did with political topics, at least until mid-1935, and in more internal topics until 1938. And you can find a lot of reflections about the questions of time and space in the Jewish press, and also it represents the different political views, the Zionists, the more liberals, the German patriots. It also presents, you have a children press, we have women press, was women magazines were very central in my scholarship. And I would generally say that the personal sources, the ego documents, were more descriptive, whereas the press is basically more prescriptive. They are telling the Jews how they should behave in a way, and trying to educate the children and trying to tell the women how to function. And I think that the combination of these two sources made me gave me quite a rich perspective. I used a little pictures. One of my colleagues here in Jerusalem, Professor Ofer Ashkenazi, is doing parallel to me a project using extensively pictures, and we're also cooperating. We published an article together. We might do another research together. This is another very rich source from the period.
It's this discussion also really brings out elements like gender and social class, which flow out of the material themselves, I think, in really natural ways. I appreciated your attention to these categories throughout the discussion, and I wondered if you could elaborate on that a little bit more. I mean, it seems like on one hand, what you're saying is that Jewish men were both victimized more by the Nazi regime, but also had a certain level of privilege by virtue of their gender, that they could sit down and assemble their thoughts, continue reading, continue to function as intellectuals in a way, while women were doing the work that made the survival of the family possible in a way, the going outside, gathering provisions, keeping things together, and class as well, because many of the protagonists of your book are people who have a level of education, a level of leisure time that their thoughts are kind of worth transmitting. And so I wondered if, how class really functions in, it seems that class and gender are very connected to space and time in all kinds of ways in the analysis. And I wondered if you could elaborate on that even more.
Yeah, I can try. I would add to this also the perspective of location, of where you live, because if you live in Berlin, if you live in a medium town like, Nuremberg or Karlsruhe, if you live in a small village, it's a very different perspective, and the experience of Jews in Nazi Germany was very different. Dealing with the gender question, I think Jewish men were victimized twice. Once, or actually the second time, was when the Nazi policy, especially in the last years, the 1930s, especially during the pogrom, was much more harsh towards Jewish men. But in the first place, because the pre-1933 bourgeois harsh division of labor, which made most bourgeois men having careers, whereas women dealt with daily life and dealing with reproduction. I mean, there were some women doing careers. There were some women Jewish intellectuals. Yeah, Eva Reichman and a few others, but mostly Jewish men had more to lose. So for Jewish men, and Mario Kaplan is writing it in their fascinating history analysis of this period, which were much more traumatized already in 1933, because the routine was much more severely and violently cut. Whereas for most of the Jewish women who had to take care of daily life, domestic life, children, they continued in more difficult situation, but they continued their daily life. Whereas the Jewish men had to reinvent themselves, even in the condition of 1933, before the pogroms, before the concentration camp. And this also encouraged them to write. I mean, I think that definitely Klemperer and Kohn, which wrote the diaries even before, are much more invested in writing their diaries after 1933 because of this cultural shock, because they're in a way more offended. In a way, writing diaries is a way of the bourgeois intellectual educated person to express his helplessness in a way, whereas Jewish women in a way are less helpless, at least in the first years. And when it comes to agency in the more practical sense, this is expressed in the correspondences where women are very active, mostly as mothers, as siblings, writing to relatives, and they are very active in correspondences, not less than men. When I come to class, it's more difficult because people from lower classes and for less educated, you cannot find so many sources. I mean, this is very easy to say. Even those who were writing in smaller places, in smaller cities, sometimes in, I wouldn't say really villages, but small towns, are mostly the more bourgeois element of the society. About the others, you might know something from the Jewish press, from the local Jewish press. But here again, most of the Jewish press is concentrated in the cities. But we have to remember, German Jewry was very urbanized. One third of all German Jews lived only in Berlin in 1933. And if you go to 1938, it's even more than one third, maybe 40, 45%. So also the representation in relative numbers is different.
Right. And I wondered if you could also talk a little bit about how space, as you describe it in the book, really narrows for German Jews, and kind of what the experience of a more constricted space, how that was perceived, how that was expressed in some of your sources.
Yeah, so my analysis of space, which is the first part of the book with three chapters, is always a tension between, on the one hand, the narrowing of the space because of the Nazi persecution policy and the social atmosphere on the one hand, and on the other hand, the agency of Jews struggling to recreate their space even though this terrible circumstance. And this tension is a very fundamental topic I was interested in, because if I was dealing only with the Jews as victims, I think it would be less interesting and innovative. I mean, the tension between the two. And I said that writing the diaries is expressing helplessness, but writing a diary is also expressing agency. And writing a diary is also creating a space, not a physical space, but a mental space. And one of the articles I published as part of this project dealt exactly with this, with writing as creating a space as part of this agency. So helplessness is only one part of this. So very simply, as the Nazis come to power, the public space is being more and more restricted to German Jews. It's very different in different places. Actually, in Berlin, in the bigger cities, it takes more time, and Jews can be more flexible and more seen in the public space until the mid, even the late 1930s. In smaller places, it's much more immediate and total. I mean, you could find places that after a few weeks of the Nazi regime, the central and only Platz in the city is called Adolf Hitler Platz, and it is forbidden for Jews to be in Adolf Hitler Platz, which means they have to be close at home and maybe in their small personal yard and don't have a public space anymore. But if you go to the major cities, it's very different. It's not only the street, but you can think about many other public spaces. I'll give one or two examples. I had part of the first chapter dealing with public spaces is dealing with libraries. We talked about intellectuals. So for Kohn and Klemperer being scholars in the 1930s, the library was actually the center of their daily life. And the experience of being expelled from the library step by step is a terrible experience of narrowing their, not only their physical space, but also their mental space and the way they create their daily life. And both of them were traumatized and victimized because of this on the one hand, and each one of them find a fascinating way to reinvent himself and his daily routine as a scholar and an intellectual after this happened. I mean, Klemperer said, okay, I cannot continue my research about French literature in the 18th century because I don't have access to these sources anymore. So I will write my curriculum vitae, and I will write about my personal life and create it as a scholar, and I will write about the Nazi language as a scholar, and I will write in my diary a lot of insights about any book I can find as a scholar. scholar. By the way, he wrote a lot about books about Zionism and Jewish history, not because he was interested in them, but because this is the material he found. So he wrote about it. If he would found books about Chinese history, he would do it as well. This was his way to survive and to recreate his agency. Another topic that I found fascinating in Klemperer's diary and also in additional sources dealt with the experience of driving. I mean, Jews were, this is 1930s, part of the Nazi revolution is the autobahns and the expanding the possibilities of many Germans to drive. And some of the Jews initially joined this revolution. And Klemperer is acquiring a driving license in 1934, 35, and he's writing so much about his driving. This is exactly what, if you read Klemperer in the more traditional way, looking for his political views or Jewish identity, you would just skip this part about driving because it's not interesting. But if your question is space, this is the most fascinating experience to read about his driving experience as initiative of creating space, and then about how he's so much victimized in late 1938 when as a Jew he cannot drive anymore, and then it is converted to Ausflugs, to going in the evening with his wife for long night walks until the night curfew for Jews is forbidden to go out until 9 or 8 or 8 p.m. Again, struggling to recreate or to use maximum space possible in spite of these circumstances. And again, you can find a lot of expression to this also in the other sources, in the press, in the correspondences.
As someone who lives in California, I can really relate to this idea of driving, you know, the car as a kind of vehicle of freedom. Of course, the reality is one sits in traffic or so forth. But in theory, right, it's your this connection between driving and kind of liberation and agency is, I think, on some level, kind of a universal association. And I see.
Yeah, I commute every day from Jerusalem to Ra'anana. So sometimes you're stuck in the traffic jam, but sometimes this is the time I hear my podcasts and I feel my thoughts are flowing much more than, you know, sitting even in the library and working and concentrated. Something is more open. Your horizon is more open. And it's really fun, I would say.
Absolutely. And
after 1938, some time and again, Klemperer is dreaming about his car. I mean, it became something so intimate for him.
Uh-huh. And I was thinking along the same lines, at the height of COVID restrictions, when so many spaces were sealed off, there's at least walking, right? Suddenly everyone's walking and experiencing the city that way and seeing things in their neighborhoods they hadn't seen before. But walking just like for some of your protagonists, walking kind of becomes a last resort when physical spaces are often closed.
Walking is the last resort before it's even impossible to do this or you don't do it anymore because you don't feel safe. And then the last resource is the domestic space and being closed at home. And since you mentioned COVID, I would say that I finished writing the book in Hebrew before COVID, but all the process of editing it was during the period of COVID. And it made me think again about all the topics in the book, the public space, the domestic space, and the flow of time. Because all of us during COVID didn't feel the flow of time as we felt it before or as we feel it now. Something was not working at this time. And when I read about my protagonists, they had the same experience in totally different circumstances, of course, much more harsh. But this glimpse of history that we all experienced in COVID, and I think that most of us were privileged to be in a relative safe situation and eventually got the vaccine and came back to our life, maybe make us a little more open to experience what they felt. And this makes me able to say something important about the way I see this book. I think that until now, we didn't use the term Holocaust. And I want to say that I feel very comfortable about it, but because I don't deny the Holocaust, of course, but I don't use it so much as a historical term. It's better for me to speak about Jews in Nazi Germany. It's both good enough and bad enough. And if you speak about Jews in Nazi Germany, it's more easy and more self-evident to compare them and to use other scholarship works like, you know, French Revolution or Elizabeth in England on the same level. Whereas sometimes when you use the term Holocaust, it's in a way exposing it from other historical discourses are making is something very different. And this is what I did not want to do.
That brings up another question I've been thinking about, which is the applicability of these changes in perception of space and time to other situations where people are living in under persecution, where people are living, where their movements are restricted, or they're not entitled to full enjoyment of rights as the other populations are. And I'm sure you've thought about how unique the situation of German Jews and the consequential altering of ideas of space and time, how unique that is and how comparable it is to other experiences of persecution.
Yeah, I think in terms of experiencing this, I don't like to use the word unique when you speak about history, because everything is unique, so nothing is unique, and it's in a way tasteless. This is actually expressing what I think about the uniqueness of the Holocaust as a research category. You know, you can use it politically, but I don't feel comfortable with this. Of course, that, you know, if you think about refugees in different situations, they're of course experiencing this, and you know, we are now talking in December 2023. I'm in Jerusalem. There is a war here, and the experience of time and space of people in Israel and people in Gaza, people in the territories in the West Bank, people under occupation, they are highly restricted in different ways. I mean, of course, everybody is experiencing this experience of time and space. And if we go to even more prosaic situation, you know, if somebody is commuting, and during the time I wrote the first two chapters, the chapter about the domestic space, I happened to be commuting more intensively than now and spent some of the nights not at my home, but in nearby Ra'anana. And then the question about what is home and where is my home? Is home where I sleep? Is home where where I do this and that? Is home where my belongings, where my stuff is? In one of the seminars, I talked about the book. I was asked about, you know, old people leaving their homes, going to old age homes and having to give up most of their property, how I analyze their experience. It's you know, we're talking about human beings, and there is no human being without experiencing time and space. So what is, so to say, unique in my case? I don't think that what is unique is that it was the most terrible situation, or many terrible situations in history. I think what is very interesting here and make my work fruitful and interesting is the fact that we speak about a very bourgeois society of people with very high quality cultural fortune and education and ways and modes of expression and developed public space that were in a very short time, because of political situation, signaled and taken out of the rest of the society and experienced very harsh limitation in their time and space, and were still able very intensively to document it. I think this is quite unique. The pace, the way of documentation, the cultural fortunes of these people, all this together, I think makes it a very fruitful case study. But I will be really happy that as I use, you know, works about French Revolution, Elizabethan English, other scholars doing, I don't know, East Asian history, time and space would use my work as well.
I think that's a very thoughtful approach to the kind of getting past the hang up of uniqueness and looking at kind of seeing much broader relevance here and not getting caught in these traps, which, as you say, are maybe political or even theological questions, but not really historical questions or questions for historical research. And I think if you don't mind, I'd like to just come back to time for a bit. And there's this sort of paradox in our discussion of space that you pointed out, or a tension between being restricted and agency and kind of active, you know, struggling against those restrictions. And I wondered if you could say the same sort of a parallel tension in your discussion of time, where this population is experiencing both an acceleration of time, as you describe it, and a slowing of time, and this kind of feeling of waiting indefinitely. Again, in ways that I think many of us can relate to from the COVID experience or from other experiences where we're kind of taken out of what is normal to us. But I'm very interested in that tension as well.
Yeah, okay. So we speak about both the acceleration and deceleration process. And again, coming back to, I think, the most fundamental topic in my book, which is helplessness versus agency, which I think is very crucial. So in a way, acceleration of time until you cannot control it anymore, and deceleration of time until that you feel not alive anymore, are two sides of the same coin. You lose your agency. If you're very, you know, if you limit, you close at home, you can't do anything, you have to wait and wait and wait and wait, and time is decelerated and very passing very, very slowly. I don't want to imagine the way, for example, the prisoners now in Gaza or people in waiting helplessness that the war will be over are experiencing time. This is helplessness, and time is going very, very slowly, sometimes and terribly slowly. And you, again, you lose your agency. On the other hand, you have to decide immediately what to do in order to save your life. You have to decide immediately in one of the cases that is covered in the book, if you immigrate to the Philippines or to China or to South America, and there's, you know, one day, and you have to decide about the future of your family. And if you don't do it, you you just lose your life. This is, again, a way to lose control and to feel helpless. Still, some of the protagonists of my books are approaching it and trying to say, you know, I will find the best way to use my time. I will find the best way to make my time meaningful. And if time is moving very, very quickly, I will find the way to use life in the best way, because this is what is, you know, given to me by, I don't know, by God or by whoever. This is what I have, and I will make this meaningful. And again, I'll get back to Klemperer, because, you know, he's expressing it so beautifully in one of the entries of his diary when he's writing. I think it's around autumn 1942, and he's quite sure that this might be the last entry of his diary before they will take him away. Eventually, it didn't happen. He said, you know, I have a lot of time. I sit at home. I write. You know, his, so to say, scholarship about his curriculum vitae, about his about the way he sees Nazi language, the diary writing. I write. I read. My life in me is meaningful. I'm a happy person. And his life was so miserable. But making his the time meaningful. And this is why he did not want to go to any work that they offered him to get some money and meet people. And he said, no, I'm busy. I have work to do. I want to fill my routine in a meaningful way, and this will make me happy. I think it's quite heroic in a way.
Interesting. I think I should probably not take too much more of your time. So I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about other projects that you alluded to a couple of them in the discussion already, but other projects that you're working on and what your current research interests are.
Yeah, I will mention, first of all, the book that you mentioned in the beginning that I co-edited with my friend and colleague Scott Uri from Tel Aviv University. And just now, when there's again a lot of discourse about anti-Semitism, we published a book of articles relating to the thesis of David Engel about using or not using the term anti-Semitism, and what exactly do we mean when we use it, and maybe we shouldn't use it anymore. And there's a bunch of articles dealing with it. And in this case, I must confess, I was quite happy to be the editor and not one of the contributors, because I'm still not sure what I think about this question. In a way, if you ask me about current anti-Semitism, what I think about the position of Jews today, my answer will be, you know, I'm a historian, let's talk about it in 70 years. Still, I think this book dealing with the various question, and we collected the ideas of many scholarship, was very interesting. And my next project that I hope to do with my colleague Ofer Ashkenazi that I mentioned, we get back to this period, and in a way it was created from part of the dealing with space and trying to go deeper from the top to the context of environment and nature, and to ask how German Jews experienced the environment and nature as part of belonging to Germany, even if we go back to you know, the Kaiserreich, the late 20th century, all the process of Naturschutz in Germany versus urbanization, how the Jews were part of this or not part of it, and then how it developed until the Nazi period. Here, I think also we can do it from the perspective of the individuals, and the perspective of the community, and also using, like I mentioned before, more visual pictures. I hope this will be my next project. This is what we plan.
That's something I very much look forward to. And this, it seems to me that it's about time to bring more of an environmental perspective to this period of history. And I think the results of this research should be really broadly relevant. So it's exciting to hear about that. So, I want to thank you so much for your time. It's been really a pleasure to discuss this, to read this book, to spend some time with it, and to have this discussion today. So thank you very much, Guy.
Thank you, Paul.